Get ready to whiten those knuckles and hold fast as we talk the most dangerous, daring, and epic sea stories ever told.
Whether facing ruthless men who prey on other mariners or storms that turn calm seas into graveyards, those who go down to the sea and cast off lines enter the most challenging and dangerous environment on Earth.
Only here will you hear their stories and the lessons gained through their experience. I'm your host, Phil.
And I'm Bill.
And we welcome you aboard the Had to Go Out podcast. Before we dive into this episode, we need to provide a disclaimer. The views expressed on this podcast are those of the individuals involved and are not to be construed as official or reflecting the views of any government agency or military service. This podcast is an independent effort with no government association.
When the most is expected, the brave men and women of the U.S. Coast Guard are always ready. The National Coast Guard Museum will engage, educate, and inspire visitors by honoring the courage and skill of our nation's unsung armed service. The museum will explore the Coast Guard's rich history and current impact through interactive exhibits, STEM-based learning experiences, and leadership development programming. Find out how you can join the effort. Become a plank owner today. Visit CoastGuardMuseum.org/out. That's CoastGuardMuseum.org/OUT.
Hey, Vince here with the Rescue Swimmer Mindset. If you're a fan of We Had to Go Out, you might just like, and when I say might just,
you will
love our show, the Rescue Swimmer Mindset Podcast. Our podcast is hosted by two Coast Guard helicopter rescue swimmer veterans, Cody and myself. And each week we bring on guests that range from rescue swimmers and Air Force PJs to professional freedivers, nutritionists, and successful athletes. In the past few weeks, we've chatted with Sarah Faulkner, one of the very few female rescue swimmers, Ashley Leopard, a flight mechanic that met the president after her saves during Hurricane Harvey, and Caleb Flippin, a jiu-jitsu champion who discussed adopting martial arts into rescue swimmer operations. The Rescue Swimmer Mindset airs every week on YouTube and wherever you go to get your podcasts. If you like what you hear, don't forget to subscribe to the Rescue Swimmer Mindset podcast and share it with some other donkey you think might be interested.
One to check out is the Always Ready Collective, delivering art by and for daring fighters of the sea with their maritime-focused tattoo flash, pinups, and propaganda. Visit them on Facebook, Etsy, Instagram, and at alwaysreadycollective.com.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Had to Go Out podcast. Thank you guys for joining us. Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting the National Coast Guard Museum. And thank you for doing all that social media stuff that that gets the word out and has more people join us and listen to the stories and hopefully tell their own.
Yeah, everybody, thanks for being here. If it's your first time here, we're glad we have you. Got an epic heavy hitter on the line today, so we know it's going to be a good one. After you listen to it and you enjoy it, go back, listen to some other episodes. You can find us where you found us this time, anywhere podcasts are available. Find us on Instagram, YouTube, Facebook, any of the social media. Please, like Phil said, give us that engagement. Send us a message, tell us what you like, and give us those 5-star reviews, please, and then go become a plank owner in the National Coast Guard Museum.
I like that. Tell us what you like, and then like you can tell us what you didn't like, but make sure you give us 5 stars no matter what.
I wasn't even going to bring up with it. What is there not to like?
Right. Anytime that somebody whines about it, it's never anything too major. But hey, like Bill said, we got a heavy hitter today. This is going to be a good one. Served under the admiral that we have on the line, the flag that we got on the line at a couple of different commands that he had. And who we have on the line is Vice Admiral William Dean Lee, retired, born in Richmond, Virginia, graduated the University of South Alabama. He's a 1981 Officer Candidate School grad, had 7 commands throughout his career, including Station Atlantic City, Commander of Group Monterey, Group Fort Macon, Sector North Carolina, the 5th Coast Guard District, the Deployable Operations Group, and the Atlantic Area Commander. He was also the chief of the Atlantic Area Command Center one time, branch chief of Search and Rescue Division at Coast Guard Headquarters, and the chief of the Office of Boat Forces. Admiral, welcome to the show, sir. Thanks for joining us.
Well, hey, guys. Thank you.
Thanks for being here today, Admiral. We appreciate it. And with that introduction, what's your most dangerous, daring, or epic sea story or stories?
Well, we don't have time but for one story. And, I mean, you know, we all got, you ask an admiral for a sea story, you get a litany of them, but I'm going to tell you a true one, all right? So listen, usually guys want to talk, you know, about stories that they were personally involved in on the water, on the boat, in the airplane. But I'm going to tell you one that that unfolded while I was sitting on the edge of my seat at 2 o'clock in the morning in the comfort of my home while one of my guys was risking his life so that somebody else might live. And because once in a while, you know, when you get, first off, I'm going to tell you guys, all the fun is had by the folks who are junior, the younger enlisted members, the younger officers, because they're closer to the fire than we are when we get into the senior ranks. And when you make admiral, you get called on everything, but you're so far from the operational tiller, you don't really feel connected until, you know, you're connected with a commanding officer who is literally, from time to time, making life or death decisions. And I found myself in a situation like that one night where I was just in a support mode. I was awakened in the early hours of the morning. You know, none of this SAR stuff ever happens during the workday. It's always at night or on weekends. And so I got a call from the command center, my command center, when I was a 5th District commander a number of years ago. I wish I could remember what year it was. But in any event, we had a situation whereby a couple of commercial fishing boats had left Manasquan Inlet, New Jersey, to go offshore, family-owned business, and they were going to go steam all night and go to some fishing grounds where they routinely fished so that they could be there at first light and start plying their trade. The two brothers, brother had one boat, another brother had the other boat, and the fishing vessel Mandy Ness, which was about a 41-foot fiberglass-hulled fishing boat, had two-man crew on it. And so the master went down. They left about, you know, late in the afternoon. They were steam all night. And so the master told the first mate, he said, look, I'm going to go down. You take the first watch. I'm going to get a few hours sleep. And then I'll come back up and relieve you somewhere around midnight. So the first mate had the deck in the con, and they were steaming along. At some point, he decided he was going to go down below and get a cup of coffee or a peanut butter sandwich. And as he did that, the ship was on autopilot. And while down there, unbeknownst to him, he was on a collision course with what we believe to be an inbound commercial freighter heading into the port of Philadelphia. All of a sudden, there's a collision, and the Mandy Ness capsizes. The boat that hit them, that we never found out who it was, probably never knew what happened. Neither party was looking at radar, we suspect, in the follow-on investigation. But nevertheless, now we got a commercial fishing boat with two people on board, capsized, and the EPIRB goes off.
Hey, at least they were prepared that much, right?
Yeah, right.
Well, they had to. You know, they got federal reg. The federal reg said they had to happen. You know, they probably didn't want to buy it, but now they need it. Well, the thing works, and it bounces off the satellite and ends up notifying my command center in Portsmouth, Virginia. And so Air Station Elizabeth City. Atlantic City was immediately dispatched to the position. They were the nearest air station, as was Coast Guard Station Manasquan Inlet, or Barnegat Inlet, I should say. Barnegat Inlet dispatched a 47-footer. So, meantime, they issue a UMIB that they got a distress signal going off in such and such a position, and all vessels in the vicinity, please respond to the table. Well, the sister ship, the brother, hears this UMIB. And so he turns around, he starts calling his brother on the radio. No answer, no response. And so he turns around and he starts steaming to the location that we, the Coast Guard, had broadcast over the Channel 16 distress network. And as luck would have it, almost everybody shows up simultaneously. The 47 shows up. 865 from Atlantic City shows up, and the sister ship. And it's not a very rough night, but it's a dark night. There's not a whole lot of light. It's in January. The water temperature is extraordinarily cold. And so you can imagine this scene that's unveiling. You got the night sun underneath the helicopter. You got all lights trained from the other boats. They're looking for something. Then they find the overturn hull of the Mandy Ness. And then they very quickly locate the deckhand who had somehow managed to get himself freed from below, get out of the boat, and he's on the surface, and he's rescued safe and alive. He's pulled up onto the 47-footer. Then all eyes turn to the rescue swimmer who is deployed out of the 65. And it's a first-class petty officer named Jake Stoll. Jake Stoll gets on the bottom of the hull, and you can imagine this scene. You got the rotor wash. You got all that noise. You got the night sun and the seafoam blowing up. As only Hollywood could create a scene such as this. Jake gets on top of that vessel, and he starts banging on the hull, trying to ascertain, is there anybody alive in there? And he starts to hear knocks from the forward berthing compartment. And they start communicating with one another through the muffled sounds. Now, meanwhile, this information is being radioed back up from the rescue swimmer to the aircraft commander, back to the command center, and we got a real mess on our hands. We've got a man trapped underneath a hull. We got a rescue swimmer on top of that hull, but no way to get the policy to get up underneath that hull to save him. And so the call network kind of kicks into place. You know, you got the commanding officer there of the air station online, Captain Nick Bartolotta. Then you got the sector commander in Philadelphia, the operational commander, Captain Mary Austin, who calls the district commander, then Rear Admiral Dean Lee. And we're talking about, well, what are we going to do about this? We know the policy says that you can't send a man underneath the hull. Everybody's clear on that. We're trying to figure out how we're going to get some qualified and certified divers out there that can get underneath that hull to try to effect a rescue of this man. Well, while all the brass is talking from the confines of their living rooms or bedrooms, in my case, wherever we were, you got a crew on scene. You got several crews on scene. But you got one man on scene who really is the only human being on the planet Earth who could make a difference. And he has already started communicating with this man beneath that hull, and he is screaming bloody murder. He's knocking and he's banging. Meanwhile, you got the crew from the sister ship, the brother of the man trapped underneath that hull, and he and his crew are screaming every expletive you can imagine at Jake Stoll to get underneath that boat. You know, these guys are thinking that this is kind of like what they see on TV. You see a disaster unfold, and within 30 minutes and five commercial breaks, it's resolved. you know, they assumed that Jake Stahl and then people in that helicopter or somebody on that 47 footer has the ability to get don a scuba tank and get under there. Well, unbeknownst to them, that's not what we do. Jake is a rescue swimmer, not a rescue diver. And Jake knows the policy. Thou shalt not go underneath that hull. He can look under it, but he's got to keep at least one hand above the waterline. The aircraft commander above also knows what the policy is. But Jake knows in his own heart of hearts that he is the only person who has any chance whatsoever of saving this man, if anybody is. Because there ain't time to get a dive team out there from anywhere. The clock is ticking. The water temperature is in the 40s. The air is about to run out in that forward cabin. And when it does, that boat might just lose that air pocket and rocket to the bottom like a fallen safe. And so Jake takes matters into his own hand. He don't have time to wait for advice from an admiral and two captains. Jake's about to do what he signed up in the Coast Guard to do so that others might live. So while we're pontificating, those senior officers and I, Jake calls up to the aircraft commander, who's an 04, former Army pilot, now turned Coast Guard pilot, and asked for him to pass down two seize bottles. You know, those little bitty miniature air canister bottles that air crew use to egress from an overturned aircraft, give you 2 to 3 minutes of air.
Yes, the aircraft commander, gutsy move.
The aircraft commander at that point, then he knows the policy, but he also knows that what Jake Saul's thinking. He knows that Jake stands a better chance of surviving if he's got those bottles than if he doesn't. And if he doesn't give him those bottles, he's going to probably go under there anyway, despite the policy. So he takes his own bottle and that of his co-pilot, and they lower it down. And then Petty Officer First Class Jake Stahl does almost the unthinkable. He swims underneath, puts one of them bottles under his armpit, the other one in his vest, and he starts working his way down underneath that capsized hull. He's never seen this boat before, and it's dark and it's black in there. And he starts swimming through that cabin, through that pilot house, trying to get through all of those floating lines and charts and coffee cups and everything, and seat cushions, all that mess that you can imagine will be in an overturned commercial fishing. He works his way up to what he thinks is that cabin door where the forward berthing area is, and he gets hung up. He gets his dry suit hung up on something. And to free himself, he's got to drop the bottle he's holding, to use both hands to get untangled. And he fights his way, he gets untangled, he fights his way back out of that pilot house up to the surface. Well, now he got one bottle left. The guys on the sister ship are screaming at him, get back under there. What are you waiting for with all of the expletives that you can imagine those sailors are using on him? Imagine this pressure. Meanwhile, aircraft commander is in a rotational, he's in orbit. He's just watching down there, hoping and praying that Jake's going to pull this off, because he knew that when he lowered them bottles, he had given tacit approval for Jake to go under that boat. And if anything happened to Jake, that's the end of him as well as Jake. Jake gets his wits about him. He swims back underneath there for a second time. He swims all the way up through that pilot house, works his way through that door. Everything's upside down, topsy-turvy. He wakes his way to that forward cabin. He gets the hatch open. He reaches in there, and he feels a leg. He pulls on that leg, and he later told me, he says, Admiral, I knew immediately when I grabbed him that he was already dead, but I had to get him out anyway. So he pulls that man out of that forward hold, and as he's trying to get him out of there, holding a seized bottle in one hand and his victim in the other hand, and just kind of kicking and paddling with one free little flap of a hand, he gets hung up again. And he has to make a decision. What do I do here? Do I drop my bottle or do I drop the dead guy? And here's where Jake Stahl departs from 99% of the rest of humanity. Jake opted to drop the bottle and keep his man. He worked his way back out of there after freeing himself and hit the surface just in time. He had already aspirated a quart of water and he vomited all that seawater up, but he got his man on the surface. They eventually got him in a litter and delivered him to Atlantic City Medical, where he was pronounced dead on arrival, which is a sad ending for a very heroic story. But it doesn't matter. Jake did everything he could, everything in his power to save that man's life. He broke policy doing it, which I don't condone. But the calculus that went in to making that decision, I respect immensely. What Jake Stahl did that night was the most courageous act I have ever seen any member of any one of my units ever make. Those are the heroes of our service. Those are the people that make men like me, who have never themselves reached over the gunwale and saved another human being, but got credit for it nevertheless. Proud to be a U.S. Coast Guardsman. So that's my story, boys, and I'm sticking by it. Over.
Man. What do you say? What do you say to that? Come on.
Phil and I usually aren't that quiet when somebody's telling a story, Admiral, so I think that lets you know how good the story was. I guess I would ask, what... for a little bit of, like, I guess, insight maybe behind the curtain, what is that conversation that's going on, you know, between you and Sector and the air station commander, like, knowing that you guys really don't have any ultimate control over what's happening? What kind of conversation are you having? Are you aware of what's going on? How much of a delay is there until you're aware of, you know, I got a rescue swimmer under a hull?
Did anybody have the guts to say it before it was over? You know, like, did the report come up before it was over, or did they just let it happen because it needed to happen and then report the results to you?
Well, while we were talking about all the options and how long it would take to exercise all them options, knowing in our heart of hearts that there ain't time, we don't have time. This man's going to die before we could ever deliver a Coast Guard dive team or a state or local county dive team. And first off, you know, there's not many people trained to go underneath capsized hulls in the open ocean in the dead of night. Certainly not the local sheriff's department. And it's certainly not, I mean, it's going to take time to get there. And we knew that we didn't have time. Meanwhile, the guys that were on scene, they were just taking manner. They were executing what they knew they needed and had to do, and were willing to take consequences if they got it wrong. They made decisions, and they made hard decisions. And Jake Stahl put his life on the line. The aircraft commander put his career on the line. And I can't tell you how much I respect both of them, even though they willingly chose to violate policy. But that's what sometimes people have to do in order to do the right thing. Over.
That was just inspiring. I don't know. I love it, man. Can I re-up again? You know, like what? Unbelievable.
Let me tell you a follow-on story there, boys. So, you know, when you retire as a three-star, you've collected through the years a whole lot of memorabilia. You know, you got the bushel basket full of command coins, and you got hats and plaques and trinkets and all this mess. But the most valuable piece of memorabilia that I have sits in the middle of my shadow box in my home in Richmond, Virginia, surrounded by, you know, those old dead, you know, stars I used to wear on my collars and some other things in there, your shoulder boards, et cetera. But dead center in the middle of all of that, there's a swim mask. It is the swim mask the Petty Officer Jake Stahl, now Senior Chief Jake Stahl, gave me when the chiefs all gathered up and gave me a going away kind of little farewell thing 2 or 3 days before I retired down in Portsmouth. Jake Stahl drove up from East City where he had been reassigned to and had a little box in it. He gave me this box and I opened it up, and in there is that same mask he wore on the night of that rescue. And he had engraved on the front of it, Coast Guard Rescue, you know, AST Emblem, and the words, "So that others may live." I can't tell you how much that means to me.
Yeah, what a gift for somebody to give you, really.
Yeah. From the most courageous guy that I ever served with. So let me tell you guys, it ain't about how high you climb the rank ladder. It's about the legacy you leave behind. And it's you guys down there close on the very front end of the operational lines that have the best legacies. You and the Jake Stahls of the world. God bless all of you.
That was awesome, Admiral. What a story. Incredible story.
Inspiring. Yeah, like I said, Phil and I usually aren't quiet during stories. Usually we ask some questions, but there's nothing to add. That's just, I'm sitting here in awe of that guy because, you know, I might wear the same uniform as Jake Stahl and might be in the same service, but I don't know. I want to think that I go under that hull, but I've never been in that situation. And until you're there, you don't know. And what a thing to do.
Well, every boat check ride, right? Like that's the, you know, those all the Star Trek nerds out there, like the Kobayashi Maru. Remember that right. Whole scenario? Yes. That's what that is to the
Phil,
Coast Guard.
You just went full nerd.
But dude, is that not the Kobayashi Maru of the Coast Guard?
It's the unwinnable. It's the completely unwinnable scenario. Right.
You do not win this scenario.
Wrong.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right. So, hey, there's, you know, you remember there was an old guy, you guys probably are too young to know who I'm talking about, but there was an old radio commentator named Paul Harvey.
Good day.
Harvey. Yeah. Well, that's right. Well, Paul Harvey always ended with the little tagline, and you know, and that's the rest of the story.
Yep.
Yep.
Well, let me tell you the rest of the story.
Uh-oh.
So here's a petty officer who has risked his own life to do what most people would never do. And he comes out with his victim, and despite the fact that the man didn't live, it wasn't due to any lack of effort on his part. So I asked his commanding officer, just me and him, on that phone call the next morning when we both got a little bit of sleep and got to chat about it again. I said, Nick, you know, we all know Jake broke policy doing this, but that was the damnedest, most courageous act of courage I've ever seen. What do you want to do with
it? We've got a lot more of this episode to go, and we'll get right back to it after this short ad from our sponsor. We're going to give you a key number about the future National Coast Guard Museum, and that number is 5.
There are 5 themed storylines: lifesavers around the globe, enforcers on the seas, defenders of our nation, champions of commerce, and protectors of the environment.
The exhibits and galleries in those storylines will be showcased in a 5-story museum.
And here's our favorite 5. For as little as $5 a month, you can be a plank owner and support construction of the National Coast Guard Museum.
For details on how you can get involved, go to coastguardmuseum.org/out. That's coastguardmuseum.org/OUT.
And Captain Bartolotta paused a second. He says, "I think we ought to give him a medal." And I said, "Yeah, so do I."
Nice.
You write it up, send it up. Well, this came on the tails of a number of aircraft mishaps that we'd had across the country. And we had really cracked down as an organization, and rightfully so, on any sort of policy violations, safety violations, et cetera. And so we were really cracking down hard on that kind of stuff. Guys, there's rule books. There's SOP. Y'all stick with it and you're safe. Don't deviate from policy and protocol. Well, here's a guy that did. And so I decided before I penned, you know, this case now is starting to get, it had grown legs. People starting to hear about the actions. There was an investigation. Of course, you got to investigate something like that. And so Captain Bartolotta sent me the wording for the medal. And I forgot what medal. I think it was the Air Medal. Let's just say, for the sake of argument, it was an Air Medal. And I was ready to sign that sucker and get it to him. I'm going to fly back up there and give it to him. But then I called. So I called then the guy whose opinion on this matter I trusted most, and it was Vice Admiral John Currier, the senior aviator in the Coast Guard. And I said, "Admiral," I told him the story. I says, me and his commanding officer want to reward him for this, but I know that everybody's tightened down the hatches on the safety stuff so much. I says, "Would you have any problem with me giving him this medal in light of the fact that he broke policy?" Well, he gnawed on it for a second, and he comes back and he says, "Dean," he says, "I'm with you. I agree that was a courageous act, but we can't give him a medal right now because that would send the wrong message. That would send the message to the rest of the fleet that we kind of expect you to do that. Or if you break the policy, there's no accountability for it." And so Jake didn't get his medal. I flew up there several days later in a little Coast Guard auxiliary airplane. And on the way up, I took out a piece of my stationery and I wrote down a note from me, his district commander, to him. And it basically said, you know, in so many words, "Dear Jake, what you did on the night of January 11th, 20, whatever the date was, that was the most courageous act of any member of my team I have ever seen. I would hope I would have half the courage you did. As much as I admire you for that, as much as you deserve an official reward, I cannot give you one because of the message it would convey. But I wanted you to know by this letter alone how much I admire you and your courage and your devotion to duty." And I signed it, William Dean Lee, you know, Badmore, U.S. Coast Guard. I handed that to him because I wanted him to have something in his box of memorabilia that one day his kids will clean out and they'll see that letter and they go, "Whoa, look what Dad did." Because there wasn't going to be any medal citation. Well, I gave him that letter and he still has it. He said that was more valuable than any medal he could have ever gotten. But then, to finish the story out, 5 years later, 5 years to the date after Jake had effected that rescue attempt, I called up his commanding officer, who has then been transferred, found him and says, hey, you still got that award citation anywhere in your computer files? And he's one of them pack rats. He has it. I said, yeah, well, dust that sucker off and send it to me. I was then the Atlantic Area Commander. John Currier and everybody else had since retired. I took that medal, I signed that air medal, and I had his commanding officer fly down, meet me at Elizabeth City, where then now Senior Chief Petty Officer Jake Stahl is stationed. And Jake was brought in thinking that he was going to be the guest speaker for the next batch of rescue swimmers, all these greenhorns out there. Well, I walk out there. He had no idea me and his former commanding officer were showing up. And I tell the story to all them greenhorns. And I turn around and pin a medal on Jake. It's never too late to do the right thing, guys. And that's my message for today. Jake Stahl is a man that I wish I could be. And I will forever admire him and those like him and you guys that are still applying to trade. Over.
Hear, hear. I don't know. I know, right? What do you even say? What an epic story, Admiral. All around. So many lessons.
And what a way
that.
To wrap it up, too. Like, that's awesome how, you know, he did deserve it, and he did get it. That's awesome.
Unwinnable scenario might take 5 years, right? That is wild. What a heck of a story. Well, Admiral, we got to ask you a couple more questions.
All right.
You know, since we got you on the line, can't let you off too easy. So you were in command of 7 different units. What are the lessons learned from that? You know, aside from the ones that you just shared with us with, you know, your bravest member out there.
You want my, you know, that lessons learned. Man, I could fill up a legal pad with lessons I learned the hard way by making the wrong decision. But I'll boil it down to one simple statement. If I were standing in front of an auditorium filled with 1,000 young officers who were going to grow up and be in command of anything, and this would include chief petty officers too, who are going to be OICs, I'll give them this one piece of advice. I said, guys, look at me, make eye contact. You remember this if you don't remember anything else. Your job is not to be the smartest guy in the room. Your job is to be the leader. Don't ever forget that. And that's it, guys. It's no more complicated than that. The only time I was the smartest guy in the room was when I was in a room by myself. The smartest thing I ever did was find out who on my crew, who on my team that I inherited really was smart, and to tap into their brilliance as often as I possibly could and to listen to them, because that's how you build a team. The worst thing any of us can ever do as a leader is to assume that just because we're the leader, we've always got to be right. And I think that's the biggest failure of most of the toxic leaders that I've ever run across or worked for. Over.
Can't beat that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get, man, it's hard. So it's hard to talk to you, Admiral, because like you give these like
it's
insanely
great.
Yeah. It's like you got to mull it over for a second to, you know, get the depth of the whole thing. It's phenomenal. Well, I'd ask you this one too, sir. So you did several groups, and then you were there for the sector transition. And a lot of the guys that you're talking about that are out there, you know, reaching over the gunnel, have worked for both. What's your opinion of the change and the way that the service kind of either advanced or changed between groups and sectors?
Well, I had two groups, and then I had a sector, and I was also on the sector implementation team. So you're asking the wrong guy. I mean, I was told by then, Admiral Tom Collins, when he was the commandant, you guys come up with a plan to create these sectors. And so we took, as I recollect, it was like 43 groups and 52 MSOs, and you kludge them together to create these sector things. And of course, there was a lot of consternation amongst the rank and file of both communities, you know, the M community as well as the response community, because they were losing commands. You know, we ended up with, my memory is fading a little bit, but I think we ended up with 37 sectors, give or take a couple. All right. So there's fewer command opportunities. And so everybody's going, well, what the hell? What, you know, is the juice worth the squeeze? Well, I can tell you, I think it is. And even though there was a lot of pushback from the rank and file, when I went in the later years after we had formed sectors and I was speaking to the sector command cadre, the courses coming in, and a lot of them had already been sitting in these command positions. I said, I asked them, I said, all right, did we get it right or wrong? Are we better off now or worse off than we were before we sectorized? And almost unanimously, all of them said we're better off. Because what it did was it gave that person who had the authority, the power to control the ports, which was the captain of the port, heretofore the MSO commanding officer, now the power and the to use operational assets to support their authority. It just made good sense. There's no more, you know, asking Mother, may I use your boats to implement what I think is necessary in my ports, where you had dual concurrent jurisdiction. And so it was a move in the right direction. It did create fewer command opportunities, but that's not what it's all about. Nobody has the inherent right to have a command. What we sign up for, and I hope that we never forget, is that we sign up to serve. And it's needs of the service. And I think the service is served better by fewer commands with more centralized power. Over.
Solid, sir. I said we wouldn't ask you any tough questions, but we had Commander Steve Love on the other day, and we asked him about the RBS2 procurement, so we figured we'd just hit you with a hard one too, just for the fun of it. You killed it, sir. You basically you pinned the whole fiasco on OSs is what I took from that. What do you think, Bill?
We knew that.
Man, I'm going to get in trouble for that one, aren't I?
They already don't like you.
I know they
so
don't.
It's, there's no difference.
All right, listen, boys. Even though I was involved with the boat, you know, broke procurements back when I was chief of boat forces, I have lost sight of what they're doing now. So I couldn't comment even remotely on the RBS2.
No, you don't want to. Sir.
No,
we use it as a joke anyway. It's just a joke. It's fun to mess with anybody that had a hand in it. Well, Admiral, just talking about how the service advanced and you were there for the ride and probably leading the way. How about the time as the deployable operations group commander? What could you speak to on that one?
Well, I only had it for a year.
Was it?
There was only two commanders. There was Admiral Tom Ekin, and then there was me. And then Admiral Papp when he became commandant, he wanted to reorganize, and so he disbanded the dog, and that was the end of the story.
Yep.
But for the year that I was there, I enjoyed it immensely. Great group of people.
And then you took over Land Area after that?
No, I went from there to the 5th Coast Guard District.
Okay.
And then I did a tour at headquarters as the deputy DCO, and then I went to Atlantic Area Commander, and then from that I retired.
Well, you're one of few flags that we've ever talked to, sir. So could you, like, you know, we've asked before some guests, could you lead us behind the curtain? You know, what goes on at these higher commands that most of us are never privy to see? What makes it all tick? How do you guys keep track of it all?
It's magic.
It's magic. PFM.
That's what we all figured. At least that's now we it. Know that's it.
Magic in a dartboard.
You guys, look, I know that there's a bit of mystique, but you know, what goes on in them big old conference rooms with all that fancy plush chairs, but the bottom line is this. You get together, if you lock a bunch of admirals in a room, and there's nobody else in the room but them admirals, they revert to behaving with each other just like they did when they were JGs. Okay? we put the stony face on when we come out behind that curtain. But the fact of the matter is, if you come into the pipeline as ensigns and JGs with a heart for service, you will keep that heart for service all the way up to wherever you end up. Commander, captain, admiral, whatever it is, you just learn to be a little bit mature in how you handle it. Again, at the end of the matter, it's, you know, I had a, and I'll leave you with this because I know we've gone way long here. This was the way I went about my business was simple because that's the way I think. I'm just a simple-minded man. And I had I had this little nameplate made that sat on the front corner of my desk at one of my, you know, former commands, like lieutenant. Let's just say I was a lieutenant in Atlantic City. Had a nameplate made up, and it just had on the front of it my name. It said William Dean Lee, and it had the Coast Guard symbol on it, but it didn't have my rank. It didn't have my title. It didn't have any of that stuff. Just William Dean Lee, U.S. Coast Guard. And, you know, it sat on the dead center middle of my desk right by my Bible. But it wasn't there because people needed to know my name when they went in there. They already knew who I was. You know, you already had to get through the gate and had to get through the whoever the gatekeeper was to get in there. But it was there because it was a facade for what was on the back of that nameplate, which faced me and me alone, which was my mission statement every day. The first thing I saw when I sat down behind my desk with my cup of coffee in the morning, right after I cut the lights on, getting ready to log on to my email, was the back of that nameplate. And on it, I had inscribed a different name, a different statement. And it very simply said, serve first, lead second, stay humble. I took that with me to every command I ever had. And the whole point in that is, first and foremost, our job, our duty as Coast Guardsmen is to serve. We are public servants. When you put that first, you'll succeed. When you put you first, you're headed towards shoal water, because sooner or later, somebody is going to trip you up if they think that you're all out for yourself and not for them. And so the final statement I'll make, and from a man far smarter than me, when I went to Capstone, when I went to Capstone, which is that executive leadership development course that all officers go to when they get promoted to a one star, I went down to Joint Forces Command for a briefing, and at that time, General Mattis was the JIFCOM commander. General Mattis came in there, and now he's a four-star, and all the rest of us are one-stars. And his staff had given us 4 days worth of PowerPoints. I mean, we just got PowerPointed to death. But every once in a while, General Mass would come in there, and he'd like wrap up a day. Well, on the final day, when we're about to leave, he come in there, and he's standing up there. You know, General Mattis, if you ever saw him, he's a man's man. He ain't more than 5'6" or 5'7", not a very man, but he filled the room up when he walked into it. But he stood up there, and he gave us a piece of advice I will never forget, and I'll pass it to you. He says, listen, guys, he says, I want to congratulate all of you for making admiral or general, whatever the case was. In that case, in that room, there's 48 of us from all the services. He said, but I want you to remember one thing as you climb that ladder. He says, you know, there's going to be a certain percentage of you, maybe 50% of you might get a second star. You know, another smaller percentage might get a third star. And if you're lucky in a room this size, maybe one of you, perhaps two, might get a fourth star. And statistically speaking, he was about right. But then he said this. He says, no matter, I want you to remember this, boys. No tree ever grows so tall that a small dog won't piss on it. Now, I did exactly what you did. I got to laughing, but then I got to thinking about the depth of that statement, because it was so true. I wrote it down, and I have never forgotten it. And that's about humility. We have to remember to keep ourselves humble, because when we get too big for our britches, somebody else will strip us down to size. And we've seen that happen time and time again with chiefs and officers of all of the services who forgot the fundamental principle. Serve first, lead second, stay humble. Guys, it's been great talking to you, but we've gone way over time here.
No, sir. We so much appreciate your time, sir. We appreciate your stories.
Thank you so much, Admiral. That was it's a lot to think about now.
It really is.
Gave us stuff to think about for sure.
Hey, Admiral, I did tell you, sir, that you know, at the end of the show, we'd ask you what initiative or cause is near and dear to your heart that we could drive traffic and send people to. You got the answer to that one?
That you could drive traffic to.
Yeah, or just you know, lead people to whatever. Cause or side hustle, whatever you might have, that now that you're in retirement, that we could tell people you're interested in, they should be interested in.
Boys, I'm going to be serious now. I've been serious the whole time, but I'm going to be ultra serious now. In these days and times, in this broken country that we're in, And I don't care what side of the political fence you're on, everybody can agree on one thing. Our nation is broken. And my view of it is there's only one person. And you're not going to be able to even say this on air, because people don't say this anymore. But there's only one person that can fix this. And in my view, it's Jesus Christ. And if you don't know about him, go study the gospel. Go find somebody who can tell you the gospel, because that's the only thing we got hope for in our nation and in our world. Drive them to Jesus Christ. That's my bottom line answer.
Fair enough, Admiral. Sir, we so much appreciate your time. Thank you for sharing your stories, and thank you for your support of the National Coast Guard Museum and your 36 years of service in the Coast Guard. Semper Paratus, sir.
Thank All right, much, boys. Sir. If you run out of sea stories, I got about, you know, 100 or two or so more. Call me back.
All right, sir.
See you later. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Before we end this, we want to give a plug for some people and organizations that we believe in.
The Coast Guard Foundation supports the brave men and women of the Coast Guard when they need it the most, providing everything from financial aid to families in crisis to scholarships and playground equipment. As a nonprofit 501c3 charity, they count on our donations to deliver this support. Visit CoastGuardFoundation.org. That's CoastGuardFoundation.org to read about their programs and donate what you can to support those who guard our nation's coast.
Thanks for taking the time to listen.
If you like what this podcast is about and what we delivered, look us up at theyhadtogooout.com or your favorite podcast platform and like, comment, subscribe, and share so we can keep the momentum up and do bigger things going forward.
Look for a new episode every Sunday. Until then, fair winds and following seas. Get ready to whiten those knuckles and hold fast as we talk the most dangerous, daring, and epic sea stories ever told.
Whether facing ruthless men who prey on other mariners or storms that turn calm seas into graveyards, those who go down to the sea and cast off lines enter the most challenging and dangerous environment on Earth.
Only here will you hear their stories and the lessons gained through their experience. I'm your host, Phil.
And I'm Bill.
And we welcome you aboard. They Had to Go Out podcast. Get ready to whiten those knuckles and hold fast as we talk the most dangerous, daring, and epic sea stories ever told.
Whether facing ruthless men who prey on other mariners or storms that turn calm seas into graveyards, those who go down to the sea and cast off lines enter the most challenging and dangerous environment on Earth.
Only here will you hear their stories and the lessons gained through their experience. I'm your host, Phil.
And I'm Bill.
And we welcome you aboard. They Had to Go Out podcast. Get ready to whiten those knuckles and hold fast as we talk the most dangerous, daring, and epic sea stories ever told.
Whether facing ruthless men who prey on other mariners or storms that turn calm seas into graveyards, those who go down to the sea and cast off lines enter the most challenging and dangerous environment on Earth.
Only here will you hear their stories and the lessons gained through their experience. I'm your host, Phil.
And I'm Bill.
And we welcome you aboard. They Had to Go Out podcast.